Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Easter Sunday with an examination of religion in America, the most religious of all advanced industrial nations. Frank Schaefer, whose father was one of the founders of the religious right, joins us to look into the religiosity of the televangelical world of megachurches that preach right-wing politics, the gospel of prosperity, hatred, and exclusion. Then Andrew Sullivan joins us. He has an essay at the Daily Beast, Christianity in Crisis, and we will discuss the politicization of religion in America and how Christianity might be returned to the core teachings of the prophet Jesus, a homeless man who rejected materialism and ministered to the poor, the sick, and the downtrodden. Then finally, we'll examine the separation of church and state and how it might apply to Mitt Romney and his relationship with the Mormon faith. A former priest who became a civil rights worker, anti-war activist, and community organizer, James Carroll, joins us. He is the author of Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the ancient city that ignited the modern world. And joining us now is Frank Schaefer, a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robinson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. His novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and his latest, Sex, Mum, and God. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Thanks, Ian.
And on this Easter Sunday, Frank Schaefer, where sort of, at least to my point of view, it seems like bad religion dominates good religion in a country that prides itself on its faith and on the number of its faithful. But there seems to be a complete detachment from so much of what people of faith call them, those self-designated people of faith, particularly in the evangelical movement. For example, in this current election, it's pretty clear from the Santorum supporters and from the conversations and platforms of both Santorum and Mitt Romney that many people in this country feel, for example, that affordable health care is a bad thing. So is evangelical religion in this country a front for right-wing politics, or does it have some spiritual connection?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this week there was a lead essay in Newsweek and on the Daily Beast by Andrew Sullivan, who's a commentator, both gay and Roman Catholic, a professing Christian, and an interesting and wonderful writer. He was bringing this point up, and that is that the politicizing of Christianity in America, whether it's the Roman Catholic bishops in his church who seem more concerned with other people's sex lives and depriving women of contraception than they do with what they ought to do if they were honorable men, which is resign en masse following the scandals of the last 20, 30, 40 years they've been covering up inside the church with child molestation cases, or whether it's the evangelicals who have traded the teaching of Jesus for the teaching of Ayn Rand and the Koch brothers, whose own father was a founding member of the John Birch Society, in terms of where their intellectual ideas come from. I would go further than your question, and I would just simply say that mass religion in America, whether it's the posturing of the far-right Roman Catholic bishops against gay people and women, or whether it is the evangelical, I guess, worship of the risen Ayn Rand rather than the risen Christ, we really have seen that religion has disappeared in America and been replaced by politics and a capitalist philosophy that, in fact, ironically, is the actual contradiction of the teachings of Jesus. And so it isn't so much that religion is bad religion, it is that religion has ceased to be religion. It's no longer about transcendent connection with eternal values. It's all about the here and now, winning the next election, stopping oil companies from being regulated, stopping banks from being regulated, making sure the 1% makes even more money and the middle class less. These are not religious themes. These are the themes of industrial robber barons. These are the themes of Ayn Rand. These are the themes of Darwinian capitalism let loose. So I think that speaking as a Christian on this Easter, and I am a Christian, I'll be in church with my family, my grandchildren, celebrating the risen Christ this Easter, and yet I'm a severe critic of right-wing religion posturing as religion, when really it's politics and it's business. And that's the tragedy. The tragedy is religion is actually, in the true sense of the word, disappearing. And so I would hope that our listeners today would go online and read this wonderful article by Andrew Sullivan in Newsweek and the Daily Beast, which is his Easter meditation on Christianity. And I really think it sums it up terrifically well. I would also hope they would read my new book, Sex, Mom, and God, about how this happened in America and why we've come to this place. But the fact of the matter is that's where we are. And so this Easter, to me, while looking toward the idea of the risen and eternal Christ in his teaching, which transcends materialism, which transcends the world of the flesh, and instead celebrates the world of the spirit and the soul, the sad thing is that it is the Christians in this country, not the new atheists like the recent Christopher Hitchens or the others, who have destroyed this faith. And so what an irony to think that on an Easter Sunday, it is from pulpits in America that politics is being preached, and you have to go to the cover story of Newsweek to find an actual sermon that would restore a wavering faith. And, you know, if that's not a reversal, I don't know what is.
Well, Frank Schaefer, we're certainly aware of the prosperity gospel, and I think the fastest rising, the superstar, if you will, of evangelical televangelists today is Osteen down there in Texas.
Right.
And that's what he preaches. You know, God doesn't want you to be a whiner. God wants you to be a winner. But I'm trying to find a kind of psychological underpinning for this enormous distortion of Christianity in this country. It truly has migrated from the gospel of love to the gospel of hate. And I'm trying to understand what I understand that, you know, the fire and brimstone sermon was always the way to get people's attention, whereas, you know, reading the Beatitudes may put them to sleep, you know. But what is the underpinning, the psychological underpinning, in your opinion?
I think a couple of things have happened, but I think the psychological underpinning of the turn to the right, and you might say the materialistic overcoming of Christianity in America with the prosperity gospel, for instance, and this worship of material things in the here and now, is a loss of faith in the spiritual in its entirety being replaced with religious terminology in politics. And essentially, I think it's a triumph of secularism, but in a strange backhanded way, and that is not as has happened, say, in France or the UK, where you have a lower church attendance by far than, say, in the United States, but actually a commitment to social progress and welfare, which is far more Christian in essence if you take the teachings of Christ seriously. We have the reverse, in that we have lip service to Christian values, but if you, for instance, look at Osteen and his prosperity gospel, it's a doing away with a 2,000-year tradition of asceticism and putting away the things of the flesh and this world in view of identifying with the poor and with those who have no voice. It's the reverse of that. And so today's Christian hero in, quote, Christian, unquote, America are the Koch brothers and not St. Francis of Assisi. And so what you see is that the heroes of contemporary American Christianity are billionaires or multimillionaire preachers and not the saints of the past, let alone of the present, the dispossessed, the people who have cared for AIDS patients, the people who speak up for gay rights, for this trampled minority through history that only now is beginning to get its voice in spite of, ironically, people who profess to be Christians. So I do believe that the psychological underpinning is a kind of a guilty conscience but a latching on to a form of secularism while not having the intellectual honesty to give up the trappings of faith. And so in a way, the sound and fury signifying nothing. The louder the voice of American Christianity has become in its proselytizing, in its drum beating, in its televangelists, in its radio programs, in its publishing industry, they're further away from anything that could remotely be related to the actual life example and teaching of Christ it has become. And so we're in a situation in America where I think the Christianity of today, when you're talking about the mass movement, of course not individuals, and there are many exceptions, as well as many exceptional pastors and so forth, but in terms of this mass movement that's been so politicized, it's not just the opposite of Christianity, it is an anti-Christian movement which makes people like the late Christopher Hitchens look like saints by comparison, because all he did was attack the corruption of the church through history, which needs attacking more than ever, whereas these people masquerading as those speaking with a religious voice are actually doing more to create legions of people who lose their faith, who become, they think, the enemies of Christianity, when in essence what's happened is they have been hounded and driven. I'm thinking of the women who are hounded and driven from the Christian fold by a misogyny which laces the right-wing Christianity, or the gay people who are hounded and driven from the Christian fold, or just those people of good conscience who look at the utter corruption of what's happened with the Roman Catholic bishops, for instance, that literally seem to want to live out Christ's parable about straining out the gnat while they have the you know, swallow the camel, or the beam in their eye, you know, while they look at the speck in their brother's eye. These are people who worry about women taking the pill, who have had an organized cover-up of a worldwide pedophilia ring for the last 50 years that became so serious in its consequences that they were virtually kicked out of Ireland. Unthinkably, the Catholic country has begun to break its ties with the Roman Catholic Church. You know, this is no time for the Roman Catholic bishops to be holding forth on their idea of what civil rights are, which is their right to deprive women of contraceptives in their institutions. And on it goes. And so I just think that when you look at the psychological underpinnings of this, it's that having adopted a completely secular, materialistic outlook of church leadership that protects the institution rather than, for instance, the child or the evangelicals that project a prosperity gospel and worship the great almighty dollar along with Ayn Rand instead of Christ, that really it's a kind of a guilty secularism. This is a complete loss of faith, and it is replacing faith with really secular trappings. So, you know, they could still argue the earth is 6,000 years old and say they take the Bible literally, but since they practice none of its essential teachings when it comes to the New Testament life and teaching of Christ, this protesting loudly that they're protecting these traditions while actually flouting them is a worse, far more damning secularism that judged by the actual actions and consequences is much more hardened than the new atheist movement. And so in a sense, and I keep using him as an example because I've written about him in my book Patience with God, but you know, when you take a Christian, Christopher Hitchens, who was supposedly an enemy of God, actually, I think he was the friend of God, because he had the honesty to say, look, if this is what religion is, it's insane. And so I don't blame him in the least bit for absolutely rejecting the basic tenets of faith as lived out by example by these folks. So I think that someone like myself, who in a book like Sex, Mom, and God argues for what I hope is a compassionate, tolerant, inclusive Christian faith, the irony is that someone like me has to do that, argue what I would consider to be the traditional faith in the light of denouncing the absolute corruption of what we think of when we hear the word Christian today. And so it's been a complete reversal. It's ridiculous. And on this Easter, I think it's worth pondering that it is from the pulpits across this country, Roman Catholic, Protestant, Evangelical, and others, with many exceptions, of course, but generally from the pulpit, that the greatest attack on Christ is launched by politicizing the faith and turning it to the right and saying somehow that if you vote Republican, this is a manifestation of Christian faith, or that we're concerned with what women do with their fetuses, but not concerned with the fact that we're destroying the globe step by step by giving people like the Koch brothers the ability to donate to corporate funds to American politics and corrupt the whole system for their own personal gain. You know, when you look at these things, they're just so momentous and so awful that this is a tough time for someone who wants to be a Christian. And yet I think that the defense of Christianity is that it's always the outsider, the person without the voice that represents the true faith, not the establishment. And that's always been the case from the time of Christ till now.
I thank you so much for joining us here today on Easter Sunday.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Frank Schaeffer, a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaeffer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaeffer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead him to his departure from the evangelical movement, and his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and his latest, Sex, Mum, and God. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Andrew Sullivan.
Well, I don't care if it rains or freezes, long as I got my blessed Jesus riding on the dashboard of my car. Through all trials and tribulations and my travels through the nations with my blessed Jesus I'll go far. Oh, blessed Jesus.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andrew Sullivan, who writes for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, where he has a column, The Dish. He's a former editor of The New Republic, a weekly columnist for The Sunday Times of London, and the author of several books, including Virtually Normal, Love Undetectable, and The Conservative Soul. His latest article at The Daily Beast is Christianity in Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Sullivan.
Thank you very much for having me, and happy Easter.
And happy Easter to you, too. And you mentioned in your article that President Obama's recently at the National Prayer Breakfast in the White House, where he invoked Jesus to defend his plan for universal health care. Given what's happening recently, divine intervention is going to come, if it comes at all, in June, right?
Yes, but the point of my piece was really to try and say that is that those of us who try to be Christians should resist the temptation to use our faith as a way in which to enforce a different politics on other people. The politics and religion are really not good partners. That if you fuse religion with politics, you end up with a certainty and an absolutism that makes a conversation and compromise very, very hard. And you also deny religion itself, especially Christianity, its core message, which is that it's not of this world, that it's apolitical. It's about transforming ourselves rather than controlling others.
But to take your faith, the Catholic Church, as an example, there is, of course, a struggle within the Catholic Church between what was called liberation theology, those that toil in the fields of our Lord, if you will, and those in the Vatican and the American bishops who are more involved with the sort of abstraction of majesty and ritual. And surely that, in a way, there's an analogy with the Catholic majority on the Supreme Court, although there's one on the left side, if you will, that's a Catholic as well, Sotomayor. But what went on in those recent...
I would agree with the Vatican about liberation theology, which I think did essentially fuse Christianity with Marxism and believed that the goal of Christianity was to create heaven on earth. And through the mechanism of communism and power. And it seems to me that Jesus, in his passion specifically, even when he was given an opportunity to defend himself from an unjust execution, refused to answer, refused to use any political leverage to help himself, and constantly insisted that his kingdom was not of this world. I don't see any parallel with the Supreme Court, except I do think that some aspects of the current Catholic hierarchy use their moral authority as disciples of Jesus to try and coerce the healthcare law, whose benefits should be judged on their secular and policy grounds, not their religious conformity.
Well, I think I probably took us off track there with using liberation theology. I really meant the notion of those that work with the poor and that follow the life of Jesus in that real sense, as opposed to the more ritualistic and abstract side of it and the institutional side of it, which is represented by the bishops. And what I saw in those recent Supreme Court hearings was a kind of detachment from the basic core of what healthcare is about, which is about human needs. There was a lot of joking about broccoli. And then on the other side, the Catholic hierarchy seems to be more concerned about women's contraception than the broader issues involved in the health of the nation.
Well, on the latter point, I agree with you. It's quite clear that for Catholics, or for any Christian, helping the poor and the sick and the needy is front and center in Jesus' message. Now, you could interpret that as the government doing it, or you could interpret it as I would, as individuals primarily doing it. As a means to saving themselves by giving to others. But I do think that the Catholic bishops' obsession with this tiny piece of the law that is financing female contraception is an absurd distraction from the possibility of universal health care, which is a very core and very Catholic and Christian proposition. And so I do think, yes, they completely missed the forest for the tree. And they've done that on several cases. And I think this is all about obsessing about minor details like sexuality when we should be dealing with the broader issue of life and death and health and how we can help the poor, especially the working poor, have some health security in their lives, which they currently do not have. But again, we have to be careful in using Jesus, because Jesus is not something to be used in our political battles. He's beyond this. And I think the message of Easter is that we have to focus. You talk about ritual versus action, and I think you can have both. There are moments in religious faith when ritual alone and beauty and the sacraments are important part of contemplating God, as long as they don't distract from our core mission as Christians, which must be to love our enemies, to love those around us, and to dispossess ourselves of all we have in order to help others. And that's what I'm getting at. I'm trying to just sort of suggest the politicization of religion, its enmeshment in the culture wars, is really a terrible thing for our politics and for our religion.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Sullivan, who writes for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, where he has a column, The Dish. He has an article at The Daily Beast, Christianity in Crisis. Well, I suppose in a way, though, the politicization of religion is alive and well, but I think you could make the case, surely, that the religious right is more dominant or powerful, at least noisy, than the religious left. The last time there was a religious left in this country was the end of the 19th century, when William Jennings Bryan ran against McKinley. And in those days, there was the rural poor and the urban poor, who are the sort of the grist for the mill, if you will, for the religious right today, were on what you could loosely call the religious left. So if it's a play...
I agree with you. I think that the temptation right now has been much worse on the right, when you have sort of the fusion of a political party with evangelicalism. I mean, we're seeing in the Republican primaries, in some cases over 50%, sometimes up to 80% of people self-identifying as evangelical, and very few of them voting for the Democrats in any way. That is dangerous. However, as I say in the piece, it's possible, I think, for Christians to bear witness to social injustice. But the way you do that is not by forming parties or trying to control legislatures or investing in a super PAC, but it is engaging in nonviolent, peaceful demonstration of injustice with civil disobedience if possible. And that is what you might call the religious left did with the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement was not, I think, although it ended up political in the Congress, at its core, its base, it was a spiritual and religious defense of the dignity of all human beings, including, obviously, particular African Americans under segregation. And as such, it was a great moral movement, just as the movement for abolition of slavery was also powered by Christian figures like William Wilberforce in Britain and also, of course, in the United States. But that's about never using power. It is about confronting power with the truth of injustice. And that line is a very powerful, important line. That's the line Jesus didn't move across. He did not say, "I'm the Messiah, therefore obey me. I'm gonna run Jerusalem. I'm gonna get rid of the Romans. I'm gonna establish a new kingdom." In fact, he allowed the Romans to pin him and execute him to a cross rather than even defend himself. That is the symbol of the renunciation of worldly power that Christianity is about. And I fear that we miss losing that. We are losing that. So I just get, you know, as a Christian, I just get frustrated at the image that Christianity has today of intolerance, of oppression, of trying to stigmatize people, of trying to control people, of ignorance and superstition, which abounds. And most young people today grow up, if they're not in an evangelical Christian household, with terrible views of what Christianity is supposed to be about. And I'm trying a little way that I can in this piece to say, you know, that isn't what Jesus said, and it isn't what Christianity should be seen as.
But if there were to be a resurrection of the real Jesus in the sense, and you start your article out, Andrew Sullivan, Christianity in Crisis, talking about Thomas Jefferson's Bible in the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C., where he went through the Bible and basically stripped out all of the words of the disciples and then kept it down to the words of Jesus. And one of the things I've always found extraordinary here in America is that in many ways it seems that evangelical religion in this country is at front for right-wing politics, particularly on the televangelical side, if you will. And, you know, Jesus never carried an AK-47, hated gays, celebrated capital punishment. As you point out in your article, he was basically a homeless man. So
he was a homeless man who was so close to nonviolence that I think you could call him a complete pacifist. He decried wealth and prosperity. I mean, you couldn't find something more antithetical to Jesus than the prosperity gospel, which is now commonplace among many megachurches in evangelical America, that says that if you believe in Jesus, you'll get rich, or that you deserve that house because you believe in Jesus, therefore get that subprime mortgage. That kind of stuff is just so alien to the gospel, to any plain reading of them, that it's really amazing that it's taken root. But it has taken root, and I think it needs to be exposed. But yeah, you know, the Christian right is the worst at this moment by far, and the use of purely religious arguments to advance their secular power is dangerous, and it's antithetical to what America was built on, which is a separation of these two spheres.
So in terms of, without going back to liberation theology, and you're connecting it to Marxism, which I assume was what the Pope at the time objected to. By the way, the Pope was just in Cuba, where he gave an impassioned sermon against capitalism. I don't know whether you noticed that, Andrew Sullivan.
He did, and communism.
Yeah.
Both. Right. The Church historically has decried both because they are essentially materialistic doctrines, and material wealth draws us away from where we need to be able to accept God's grace, which is to be profoundly empty. And that's why the Christian message is that suffering is part of God's purpose because it brings us closer to God, because it strips us of the things that allow us pride and defenses against Him, of things like wealth or fame, any of the other distractions in our current world, whether it be tweeting or Facebooking to the end of the day, or whether it be all sorts of other temptations. The Gospels say, get rid of all of it. Stand naked. Remember who you are. Remember you will die. Stand in front of your God and ask yourself, am I doing what God wants me to do? And that's not a political message. It really isn't. Neither party owns it. No person in power should co-opt it. And I think even the church authorities should be wary of wielding it. I think that's my position at this point.
Well, but if you were to describe Jesus as an example and how he inspired disciples, and that, of course, is the very nature of the Christian religion, I guess, is if you were to describe Jesus, though, Andrew Sullivan, politically, yeah, where would he come down? I mean, cursory look at his at everything he said and the Beatitudes and the example of his life and those that he'd ministered to, and the notion that it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. I mean, I don't want to bring Mitt Romney into the mix, but I'm just saying, you know.
That's between Romney and his God. It isn't about the government stepping in and acting as God,
right,
to redistribute his wealth to other people. And nowhere does Jesus talk about government in that way or politics in that way.
Right.
It is radically anti-political. Now, of course, it's also radically impossible to achieve. I mean, I mentioned St. Francis, who really followed Jesus' teachings literally to the core, and that meant no home, you have to be homeless. You can't work except physical labor. You cannot accept any payment for it except basic food. You cannot eat more than a subsistence diet. And you have no sex. You have no family. And you live sort of in the wilderness. And that is, you know, if the whole world did that, it would be a very different world and it would be transformed. But Christianity also teaches us that human beings aren't fair and that saints are rare, and therefore we have to make some arrangements with our imperfections to mitigate those. And the Constitution of the United States, I think, is one of the most canny ways in which we pit our fallibilities against one another to maintain freedom. And part of that freedom is the freedom of people to believe whatever they want to believe. So I really don't believe Jesus has a politics at all. And I think to place Jesus in a political context is to misunderstand him at the profoundest level. And insofar as we have to have politics, because we live in a world where we're all sinners, we should do so with the minimum amount of temptation for power. And that's why Jefferson, I think, was both a Christian, as he understood it, and also a fervent opponent of any concentration of power, hence the separation of powers, hence the Constitution, hence federalism, et cetera, et cetera. He was identifying Christianity with powerlessness. And that means not just not being political, but fleeing from politics and not engaging in it. And those who want to make him that, whether they're on the right, as is now overwhelmingly the case, or whether they're on the left, right, as has been the case in parts of Latin America, are really destroying his core message, even as they believe they're fulfilling it.
Well, I certainly won't belabor it and try and have you place Jesus in the left-right political lexicon, or ask you whether or not
he's in the right-wrong lexicon, not the left-right lexicon. He's always calling. The one thing he is always saying is, "Do not judge others."
Right. Well, but I was going to say, you know, arguably some people might suggest that he was a community organizer. Others, given the fact that the Romans put him to death, that he was at least, if he wasn't a revolutionary, he was seen as a revolutionary. The Book of Revelations, which is not in the Eastern Church, seems to be the obsession of many people on the Christian right in this country. Just in closing, What do you make of that kind of spiritual pornography that's associated with the Book of Revelation? Because 70 million copies of the End of Time series have sold in this country. There's a vast constituency of people who really believe that my life, and perhaps yours, should end in burning flesh so that theirs can begin.
I think it's what they used to call in Christianity heresy. And I think it's self-serving heresy, insofar as it's about elevating one group of people in the society over others, dividing between those who are godly and those who are not, where Jesus specifically said, before you do any such thing, take the huge beam out of your own eye before you remove the speck out of somebody else's. So I find the obsession with the Book of Revelation to be bizarre. I mean, it itself is an extraordinarily strange book. The idea that you look through it for predictions of future events and then seek to bring those events about—it's terrifying. This is the worst form of religious superstition. And in fact, you don't need any of these complexities. Jesus himself said, really, when asked, what are you really saying? He just said, it's very simple. Love God and love thy neighbor. That's it. And if you want a prayer, here's your prayer. It's a very short prayer. And you don't need anything else but faith in me. And to do and follow loving one's neighbor. That's a hard thing to do. That's an incredibly hard thing to do. I fail to do it every day. I'm sure you do too. That's enough. If we could only struggle to do that and succeed, have done enough. Leave politics aside and reform yourself. That's what Jesus is saying.
Well, undoubtedly, unconditional love is a lot harder than blind hatred, and we can only hope that the former overcomes the latter. And I thank you so much for joining us here today, Andrew Sullivan.
You're so welcome, and happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you. Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Sullivan, who writes for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, where he has a column, The Dish. He is the former editor of The New Republic, a weekly columnist for the Sunday Times of London, and the author of several books, including Virtually Normal, Love Undetectable, and The Conservative Soul. His latest article at The Daily Beast is Christianity in Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the Catholic theologian James Carroll.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve some. Pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair.
In the light of a golden calf, oh God, I have to laugh. The poison of your rage, don't think it finishes when you turn the page. It was wrong, but you said it was right. In the future, I will read at night.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Carroll, the author of Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the ancient city that ignited the modern world. He's a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and is a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. He served as a Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974 and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named best columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. His books include House of War, The Pentagon, and The Disastrous Rise of American Power, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and The War That Came Between Us, and Practicing Catholic. His New York Times bestseller, Constantine's Sword, provided the basis for an award-winning documentary. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Carroll.
Thank you so much, Ian. Good to be back with you.
And on this Easter Sunday, obviously, one, at least I think a lot of Americans, they're going to church and various services around the country. But this feels like there's a paradox here. This is one of the most religious countries in the industrialized world. But so much of what seems to be out there is a religion based upon on the prosperity gospel, on not so much on the notion of the Beatitudes, if you will, but more on the notion of hostility towards gays, Muslims. We have a president in the United States who's being accused of being a Muslim. So I'm just trying to get the temperature here of the real sort of nature of American religiosity.
Well, Ian, I have to admit, I see it somewhat differently. I think what you're pointing to are manifestations of what I would call normal anguish attached to what is going on at the deepest level of the human condition. We're living through a massive mutation of what it means to be a human being on the earth, with profound changes from technology to psychology, from the meaning of nationalism, the ways in which the world economy has turned upside down the traditional expectations human beings have of their lives. And, you know, given the mass of change that's taking place, the fact that there are panicked reactions that manifest themselves as bigotry, a contempt for the other, fundamentalism, I don't find it surprising. And I think we should be patient with it. I think, frankly, we could look at it, all of this, from another point of view, which is there's magnificent coping going on with these changes. We do, after all, have an African-American president. We do have, in addition to the greed that marks Wall Street, we do have this a mass movement of democracy that's demanding justice and equality, not just in the United States, but globally. We do have a kind of rising world consensus that war is not the answer. We're looking for new structures of international law, the ICC taking effect only 2 weeks ago. So, you know, massive cultural change leads to massive personal dislocation. We're seeing a lot of that. But the other side of it is people are being generous and brave. And you see that among religious people as well.
Well, I certainly see, James Carroll, the rise of fundamentalism around the world, whether it's Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, etc. And I suspect, as many do, that its connections are in reactions to globalism and global communications and these transnational and subnational security threats that now have consumed the idea of traditional national security that we had throughout the Cold War. It's clearly a much more confusing landscape. But in terms of the difference between those who seek comfort in religion and those that are inspired towards anger against the other, how would you measure that, the temperature on that?
Well, you know, look at one of the most encouraging signals I'm aware of is you have this demagogue, Rick Santorum, going around the United States inviting people to be at their worst in relationship to the other, demonizing gay people, attacking the rights of women, kind of triumphalist claims for Christianity. And look what's happening. Yes, it's true. He's attracting a solid core of right-wing evangelical voters. But look who's resisting him, even among the Republicans. Ian, Rick Santorum is a Catholic, and in every one of these primary elections, he's lost the Catholic vote. Catholic Republicans are not known for being left-wing, but they have entirely turned away from the invitation that Rick Santorum has given them. In other words, Rick Santorum represents an extreme manifestation of fear and reaction, and he's being broadly repudiated, even among the most conservative elements in this country, which is a really important signal of something. That's what I want to emphasize.
Well, would that have something to do? I mean, I assume that a lot of the rejection is coming from women, isn't it?
Indeed. Of course, you're right, and that's a very important signal. There was a poll out last week that showed that President Obama is 18, perhaps 19 points ahead of Mitt Romney among women. That's an astonishing gap. And what is the reason for it? It's because the Republicans embrace these attacks on women as a key part of the Republican platform, driven by Santorum, I would say. And Romney's big mistake, of course, is he's tried to stay up with Santorum on this. So you get a former moderate like Romney repudiating Planned Parenthood, for goodness sake. And women are not stupid. Women get it. This is an issue. The Republicans have begun to politicize basic human rights for women. And when birth control surfaced as a point of contention last month, women noticed. Let me just say, though, there is one oddity in that poll I just referred to, which is that Santorum actually does better against Obama than Romney does among women.
Well, that's pretty extraordinary,
Obama,
isn't it? I mean,
Obama's lead over Santorum, according to the USA Today Gallup poll last week, is about 15 points. His lead over Romney is about 18 points. I'm not sure what that means. We know that evangelical women use birth control at the same or perhaps even greater rates than mainstream women, other women. Once birth control becomes an issue, it's as much an issue for conservative evangelical women as it is for anybody. But I do think there is a watershed moment here, which is a revelation of the deep pit the Republican Party has dug for itself by effectively using a kind of reactionary attempt to return women to pre-modern subservience has backfiring, and that's another good sign.
Again, I'm speaking with James Carroll, the author of Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the Ancient City That Ignited the Modern World. He's a distinguished scholar in residence at Suffolk University and is a former priest who's been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer. And he served as the Catholic chaplain at Boston University and was the winner of the first Thomas Merton Award. His New York Times bestseller, Constantine's Sword, provided the basis for an award-winning documentary. So, again, there is this sort of global phenomenon of fundamentalism. In many ways, what the fundamentalists around the world have in common is, I think, a fear of women or a desire to want to make women second-class citizens. A lot of amateur psychiatry would suggest that there's a fear of women's sexuality. Do you want to touch on that? Because I also wanted to ask you about why it is that women are rejecting Mitt Romney, who now pretty much appears to have sewn up the Republican nomination.
Well, I'm no expert, but I would observe that the single most important barometer of profound social change, the move from what you might call hyper-traditional society into modern and postmodern society, is the improvement of the condition of the lives of women. So when women are educated, everything in a society changes. And when women have fewer children, social structures, from employment patterns to populations of schools and higher education, that changes too. As women take more and more control over their own reproductive lives, men have to more and more experience women as centers of equality. What we're, of course, living through is the next phase of the movement out of traditional and pre-traditional cultures into cultures where women are increasingly treated as equals, all of which is to be celebrated. The fact that it's accompanied, these changes are accompanied by upheaval and reaction isn't a surprise, because the changes go that deep in our lives. And this is going on whether you talk about pre-industrial societies and cultures like much of the Arab world, but it's also going on in the post-industrial culture of our own country, which you see being played out in this in the politics of presidential election. As for Mitt Romney, there are two factors accounting for his doing so poorly among women. In my opinion, you'd do well to ask some women, of course. Obviously, as we've already been referring to it, there is the Republican Party's assault on women's rights. that has become egregious over the last 6 or 8 weeks. But then, of course, women, like everybody, are people with two eyes and sharp intelligence, and they can see through a lot of what Romney presents. I mean, the man has apparently a few, if any, convictions. That is to say, principles on which he stands, come hell or high water, that are consistent from the beginning of the day to the end of the day. Women, like a lot of voters, are very skeptical of Romney for that reason. And that's no doubt a key part of why he's having such trouble winning over the remnant of the Republican electorate that just simply refuses to vote for him.
Why do you think his religion has escaped scrutiny, given that Jack Kennedy, when he was running, made a very, very courageous and clear speech that reinforced the First Amendment and the separation of church and state? And one would have thought that that would have given Romney an opening there, some comfort that Jack Kennedy had broken ground for him. But instead, Romney has gone along with the evangelicals in this absurd argument that somehow Christianity is under assault in this country by big government. And I'm just curious to know why it is that there's so much about his past that's so strange. His great-grandfather, of course, being a polygamist, moved to Mexico, had four wives, picked up a fifth in Mexico. His father came back here to the United States. He wasn't even born in the United States, yet he was somehow able to run for president against Nixon. And even though you can't make the analogies between a Mormon bishop and a Catholic bishop, there is a great deal of secrecy in the Mormon church. When he married Anne, her parents weren't allowed to go to the wedding ceremony, and the church is a very kind of corporate entity where it's, you know, the tithing money goes to, I'm not suggesting that there's anything nefarious about it, but it's a very wealthy religion that seems to be tied in with a lot of big corporations like Marriott and Safeco, etc. But that's not the point. It's the point. The question, I think, that should be asked is, would there be any problem with a President Romney in terms of the First Amendment if we don't quite know what his relationship is to the prophet, who's the head of the church, and to the disciples, all of whom are men, and what kind of influence that they would have over him? Again, given that Jack Kennedy repudiated that kind of notion in terms of his candidacy back in 1960, and yet Romney has not even ventured into that area, except in taking a reactionary position on the First Amendment.
Well, Romney's a beneficiary, of course, of the ground that Kennedy broke, and I think after Kennedy, it's much easier for American politicians of whatever religious convictions to run for office and, in effect, to get a pass on the religion to which they belong. You've cataloged pretty efficiently there a good number of the things that were said about the Mormon tradition. Romney has been, basically immune from the negative energy that used to accompany American attitudes toward Mormonism, although perhaps not immune from that hardcore evangelical base that refuses to vote for him. Not sure how much anti-Mormon religious bigotry is involved in that. But as for Romney's own use of religion, I think it's cynical. I mean, I think his appeal to the religious extremes of the far-right evangelical part of the Republican Party is a simple electoral ploy, including his embrace of the assault on women. But I myself am a Catholic, and I'm quite conscious that there are still, not just in Jack Kennedy's time, but in my own time, there are still aspects of Roman Catholicism today that could be troubling for someone committed to liberal democracy. The Catholic Church is in the middle of its own coming to terms with modernity, and it's not finished. And the Catholic Church has its own troubles with secrecy, with its attitudes about women, continuing to ban women from the priesthood, for example. And, of course, most obviously, being exposed as having sheltered a whole cadre of pedophile priests. If those charges that are quite clearly established now against the Catholic Church had been made against the Mormon tradition in the last 10 years, imagine what Romney would have to deal with. And yet no one is bringing up the church's pederasty scandal, throwing it in the face of Rick Santorum or Joe Biden, for that matter, who's another Catholic, or Newt Gingrich, who's a Catholic. If the Mormons were defending themselves against massive charges of child abuse and the cover-up of child abuse today, you can imagine how that would have sunk Romney's campaign months ago. And that's exactly what's going on among Catholics. So I think in matters of religion, nobody's a member of a religion that isn't guilty of tremendous failure and sin.
And therefore deserves scrutiny. My point was that there's been little to no scrutiny of
Well,
Romney.
I don't think that's true. I think Romney's there's been a lot of scrutiny, actually, about Romney's relationship to the Mormon tradition. The Boston Globe did a major series looking at that. I myself wrote a four-part series for the Boston Globe about Romney and Mormonism. The Globe series was published as a book. Romney, you know, has not. There's no evidence that Romney himself participates in or affirms some of the egregious and now widely repudiated aspects of the Mormon cult. I mean, yes, it's certainly true that polygamy is a large part of his family history, as it was Huntsman's, as it is most Mormons. But there's no evidence at all that he hasn't firmly, like the church itself, repudiated that past.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. And in spite of our conversation, I wish you a happy Easter.
Well, thank you. And I wish you a happy Easter as well. I'm always glad to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Carroll, who's the author of Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the Ancient City That Ignited the Modern World. He's a distinguished scholar and resident at Suffolk University, and is a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. He served as Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974, and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named the best columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. His books include House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us, and Practicing Catholic. His New York Times bestseller, Constantine Sword, provided the basis for an award-winning documentary. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.